Before we begin today's show, it was a wild scene in Las Vegas at UFC 256 this past Saturday night. Davison Figueiredo beat Brandon Moreno in a five-round slugfest for the flyweight championship of the world. There was blood. And a Monday afternoon, Daniel Cormier and Ariel Helwani react to the fight and all the latest going on in the mixed martial arts world. So if you're interested and want to check it out, be sure to subscribe to DC and Helwani wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Hello, welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA, which we're doing on Sunday night. Joining us from Boston, Massachusetts, is Tim Bontemps. Tim, how are you?
I'm well, Brian. How are you?
Good. And from across the country, joining us from Seattle, Washington area. I don't think you're in Seattle proper. I know Bontemps practically lives downtown Boston. You live south of the city. Is that right, Machine Kevin Pelton?
I am not technically in the city, but my mailing address is Seattle.
So okay, well, I take it all back. In case you want to send Christmas cards, just put Kevin Pelton, Seattle, Washington.
Hey, listen, just write the Machine, Seattle, Washington.
I don't think it's there. Usually Christmas cards that people want to send me after the projections come out.
This is technically an Eastern Conference preview show. If you've listened to the podcast over the years, you know that I don't like previews, so I'm being dragged into this kicking and screaming under orders from Andrew Hahn, the boss man.
To be fair to Hahn, this might be the only year that a preview this might be the first year ever that a preview is necessary for a lot of people, because a lot has happened the past few weeks.
And more could happen, you know, but all right. So I want to focus on two sort of hemispheres of the Eastern Conference, because I feel like there's kind of an arms race at two areas. One is at the top and one is sort of for the back two spots play in. But one thing that I just want to say, and this, you know, is in my view, just really sobering. I'm going to list some teams here. The Milwaukee Bucks, the Toronto Raptors, the Boston Celtics, the Miami Heat, the Philadelphia 76ers, the Brooklyn Nets. That's six teams I've listed. I did not say the Indiana Pacers, but you could argue that they should be in there as well, because they did have the number four record in the East last season. I'm not putting them there, but so it's 6/7 teams. Two of those teams, /3, if you include the Pacers, are not making the second round of the playoffs. And so this is going to be a grinder season. There are going to be some teams who are good and who are expecting to be good and have heavily invested in their rosters who are done in the first round. And that means there's going to be some dudes who get fired, and there's going to be some dudes who are under pressure during the season is my speculation. It's just going to be, there's not enough room at the end. So often we have not seen the East this way. I feel that it is this way. And I want to talk about that to start with. And Bontemps, I'm going to start with one of your teams. I'm going to start with the Philadelphia 76ers, who probably, even though the Bucks changed out a lot of their team, probably the team that will look the most different year over year will be the 76ers, with the way that they've remade their roster. They are a team that last year was expected to be very good and ended up, they were one of the teams on the outside in. And as a result, they have a new coach and a new lead executive. And their new lead executive has done a lot of things to them. I know that you have focused a lot on Philly leading into this season. Give us your thoughts on where you see the Sixers, especially in comparison to their big disappointment last year.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get dragged back into picking the Sixers to make it out of the East again, like I did last year when they were then awful, in part because I'm not whelmed by a lot of their competition's off seasons, and in part because I think this team has a chance to be drastically better. I really like the moves that they've made to swap out Josh Richardson and Al Horford for Danny Green and Seth Curry. Their team makes a lot more sense now. I think Daryl Morey I think you could probably make a pretty good bet that this team will be better now than it will be, or this team will be better after the trade deadline than it will be now, because Daryl Morey has a history of making in-season moves that are pretty savvy that help his teams get better. And I expect him to do the same thing with this team. And more than anything else, you know, this season is going to be a referendum on Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid. Literally everything else with the organization has now changed except for those two guys over the past few years. And I think that with the system that is in place, with the shooting that is around them, with the coaching that they have now in Doc Rivers, I feel like this team is as well positioned as it could be to make a deep playoff run and prove that these guys can play together. And if they can't, you know, I think the calls to break them up are going to be, you know, they're probably going to be answered, if not this offseason, soon. So I'm bullish on them, and I feel good about their chances to make a deep run, like I said. And if I had to pick right now, I think they're my pick to get out of the East.
Pelton, are you bullish?
I'm not bullish, certainly not as much so as Tim. I'm not going to pick them to come out of the East. I mean, I think what they did this offseason with the arrival of Daryl Morey is they bet on fit over talent. From a pure talent standpoint, you know, I'm not sure that Danny Green and Seth Curry are quite as good as Josh Richardson and Al Horford. But those two guys didn't fit particularly well, especially Horford trying to play him, Simmons, and Embiid together did not work. He's too expensive to strictly be a backup center behind Embiid, though you need some quality, you know, behind Embiid because of his injury history. And that's why the Dwight Howard pickup was really, I think, quite important for them. But, you know, they're hoping that the addition of more shooting is going to complement Simmons and Embiid, much like we saw a couple years ago. You know, there's Morey, I think, has even alluded to the lineup that they put out there when they had Redick, Covington, and Dario Saric as the three guys around those two players. And those lineups just destroyed teams at the end. You know, that Sixers team was playing so well at the end of the 2017-18.
I have some numbers if you'd like them.
Yeah, I was actually, I forgot, I was going to mention them when you were done, KB, because I forgot them. Go ahead, Brian.
So last season, and Bontemps has been talking about this for months, but last season when Simmons and Embiid were on the court together, they had a +6 net rating, outscored the opponents by less than a point over 100 possessions. In the 2017-8 season, which was their best lineup was Simmons, Embiid, Redick, Covington, and Dario Saric. When they played that lineup together, they were +20.5 net efficiency. So
in 600 minutes, which is a lot of minutes.
And there's other lineups you can go to, but the point is that to say that they don't work together, there is evidence that they do. Now, you mentioned how Machine, you mentioned how Horford affected them. So last season, with Al Horford on the court with Embiid and Simmons, and he was in and out of the starting lineup, and this kind of explains it why. When he was playing with them, the Simmons and Embiid combined to shoot 45%. Their average distance shot was 15.6 feet, and the percentage of their field goals in the paint, which is where Simmons and Embiid are their best, was 36%, so a little over one out of every three. When Horford was off the court and Simmons and Embiid were on, they shot 53%, so 8% better. Their average distance was 12.6 feet, so 4 feet closer. And their percentage of points, percentage of field goal attempts in the paint went from 36% to 50%. And I'm sure Daryl Morey has even more advanced stats than that. But even if you didn't have those advanced stats, you would know the difference. And I'll just give you one more interesting stat. From Second Spectrum. Last season, the top three players in generating wide open three-point shots, which wide open three-point shots, by the definition of Second Spectrum, is when the closest defender is 6 or more feet away. Luka Doncic was number one. He created 6.7 of those for his teammates per game, and his teammates shot 40% on them. Russell Westbrook was number two, not a surprise, 6.4 creating those per game, 39% his teammates shot on them. Ben Simmons was third at 6 a game. His teammates only shot 37%, which was below the league average for those wide open threes. And Seth Curry, who obviously played with Luka. That was probably one of the reasons why Luka had the higher percentage there. Seth shot 50% on three pointers last year when the closest defender was 6 feet away or more. That was third best in the league behind J.J. Redick and Joe Harris, which is another reason why J.J. Redick was a good fit playing alongside Simmons. So, I don't know. We put that in the blender. I don't know what it comes out as, but it supports what Tim is saying about just the changes made in theory should spit out better results.
To KP's point, I think what I would say the Sixers have done is rather than bet on fit over talent, they've bet on maximizing the talent of their two best players, right? And the fit around them, allowing those guys to get back to where they were a couple of years ago. You know, that's the bet they've made. And if these guys are as good as, you know, the Sixers believe they can be, and as, you know, kind of the general perception of them is, if they can be that good collected or together this year, then they've got a chance to be an awfully good team.
So I would say that, part of the reason why you're not seeing a whole lot of action between Harden and Philly, you know, discussions is because of everything that I just said. Part of it could be a negotiating point, putting together a James Harden deal, if Philly wants to do it, is it's going to be a difficult deal to put together, notwithstanding the idea that Daryl Morey just left the organization. But I really do honestly believe a machine, you know, that they want to see these lines play together. They want to see if these changes make a big difference, because just in that surface level, well, it wasn't surface level, but it was maybe, you know, a little bit deep, you know, shows what they're doing. And I'm sure that they have all kinds of more data that they're going to roll out to Doc Rivers to choose which players to play with each other when. This is one of the reasons why I don't think they're really excited about altering this right now.
Well, it was why, you know, the stat you just mentioned about Simmons setting up wide open threes is why I was, you know, laughing at this notion that when Morey came in, oh, he's got to get rid of Ben Simmons because he doesn't shoot threes. Well, you individually shooting threes is not the only way that you get threes as a team. You can also pass to guys who shoot threes, and Ben Simmons is very good at doing that. And I think, you know, definitely given his age, they want to try and see if they can make this work. But, you know, the one thing we should say is there's a reason people were so hyped about this team last year, and it was their size and their versatility defensively. And bringing in Seth Curry gives teams a target at the other end of the court that they didn't have last season. And that was, I think, the reason that they wanted to move on from J.J. Redick beforehand. So it'll be interesting. Certainly Danny Green gives them, you know, a much more balanced piece at both ends of the floor, especially if he can shoot like he did in Toronto rather than like he did last season with the Lakers. But I think that's, you know, going to be a question mark is, will this team be as good defensively?
All right. Two-time number one overall seed out of the East, Milwaukee Bucks. They obviously altered their roster a lot, bringing in Drew Holiday and revamping their bench. We've talked ad nauseum on this podcast about Giannis. Who knows whether we'll have news, whether it's Monday or whether we don't have anything for another week. But Kevin, they obviously really felt the need to shake things up. They brought in a big time defender in Drew Holiday. Do you think their changes materially alter their ability to compete at the highest level? We know they're going to be good. We know they're going to win a lot of games, but do they change, you know, basically subbing out Holiday for Bledsoe? The price that they paid to do that was very steep. Do you think that makes a big difference?
I do in the playoff setting because, you know, Holiday immediately becomes one of their top three players. This is a guy who has been nails when he's actually gotten to the postseason in the past. You know, those New Orleans teams often fell short of it, but his ability to defend multiple positions, to both create and play off the ball, all of that, I think, makes him a great fit for what they're going to need in the playoffs. To me, the question is what they did with the bench. I think it was on this podcast in our free agency preview. You know, I said that I wasn't sure that the Bogdanovic non-sign-in trade was such a bad thing for them because it was going to give them more flexibility to fill out their bench. I don't love what they did with that flexibility.
You meant they had to fill it out well, KP.
Exactly. DJ Augustine's someone who I think, you know, size issues in the playoffs, similar thing. Bobby Portis is now their stretch versatile big.
Strange signing, Bobby Portis. They gave him, what, $4 million?
Yeah, 3.6, the biannual exception. But what it did, and then it forced them to give Pat Connaughton more money because of a bit of a snafu with his contract. And, you know, Portis has been a dreadful defender during the course of his NBA career. They're counting on him to really improve in Mike Budenholzer's system. The other signings, you know, on the wing, Bryn Forbes, Torrey Craig, for the money they got those guys, I like them. But, you know, if they are in a position where they need to take Brook Lopez off the court in a playoff series because they don't feel like they can match up that way, I'm not sure who that extra guy who's going to come on the floor to replace him is going to be. And that's something I thought they needed to address this offseason.
Yeah, my thing with this team, I mean, what have we been saying about this team for 2 years now? It's right. It's that they need to have a plan B. Like, obviously, you know, Mike Budenholzer can dial up a really good regular season team, but, you know, in the playoffs last years, they've gotten completely outcoached and out-executed by their opponents because their opponents had other things they could throw at them and the Bucks couldn't respond. And I feel like, to KP's point, this offseason has left us asking the same question, which is, what is the Bucks' plan B? They don't really have one. If it was me, I would have gone into this offseason and loaded up on as many wing players as I could to try to allow the Bucks to be able to utilize these Giannis at center lineups in the playoffs and really be able to take advantage of that. But with the way they have put this team together, you know, like DJ Augustin, like KP said, nice player. He's not really a playoff player. He's a little too small to be out there against the highest level teams defensively. And Bobby Portis has never proven to be a guy who's of that kind of caliber in the playoffs. So, you know, are you going to be relying on, you know, Torrey Craig, who signed for the minimum in that spot? Like, maybe, but that's, you know, there's a good chance that's not going to be good enough. So I was with KP at the time. I really liked the Bogdan move. I was higher in it than him, but I did think that Milwaukee could have had a chance to pivot to, you know, a good offseason. So if they went out and filled in some of these pieces with better fitting parts, but instead I really was underwhelmed with what they did. And I think they've gotten worse, even though I love the Jrue Holiday move, because I just think the rest of this roster has taken a pretty significant step back.
What was their biggest, I mean, obviously defensively Holiday helps them, but Bledsoe is very good defensively. What is their Achilles heel? Their Achilles heel is when they need 2 points under pressure in the half court, where do they get it? I don't know if they've addressed that.
And I mean, I think that points to, though, the one thing that's the biggest factor for this team than anything they did in the offseason is going to be, has Giannis taken the next step in his development? Because he's got to be that guy. And we did see at the start of game 4, before he was injured in that one against Miami, he was making those kind of plays for the first time in that series. But we need to see it over a full series from him.
Yeah. A lot on the line for the Bucks. Obviously, we're going to be talking about them a lot during the season.
And the other thing that goes real quick with them is that, obviously, we've talked a lot about the extension, but if they don't sign it, I know it's a different media environment than normal, but it will be very interesting to see, or if he doesn't sign, I should say, it'll be very interesting to see how the Bucks handle that this year, because that's obviously going to come with an immense amount of pressure on those guys, and it will be interesting to see how that goes.
I thought the story about all the Bucks players coming in and giving Giannis a pen for his birthday. He turned 26, like maybe the second or third day of the workouts, and they all gave him, you know, to have Giannis tell the story, they all came up to him in his locker and gave him a pen. And it sounds like a charming story, but when Giannis told it, he kind of got annoyed, actually. I was just basing on watching the Zoom where Giannis tells the story. I can't say for sure. I wasn't there. But that just... Again, it seems like it's a nice story, but it's one of those things where you're like, yeah, because it's on everybody's mind. So no matter what he wants to say, you know, that's there. All right. Boston Celtics, who have been in the East Finals 3 of the last 4 years. Last year, only team in the league who had 3 20-point-a-game scorers, as Jaylen Brown had a breakthrough season. For years on this podcast, I've made the reference about betting on the come, which makes everybody laugh and makes me sound like an old man. They bet on the come with Jaylen Brown. I won't finish the sentence, but that's what happened. It's off Game of Craps. Relax. Jaylen Brown has a big year last year. Jason Tatum makes third team All NBA, signs super or Rose provision, super max rookie extension. But Kemba Walker with knee issues that have been dating back to last winter. I'm going to start the season on the shelf. this is your team that you're around more than any, or especially this year, on temps where we're not going to be out on the road for a while for the most part. The Celtics are, I don't know which way they're going to go. Obviously, they lost Gordon Hayward in the offseason, signed Tristan Thompson. That was kind of their biggest set of transactions. Is this team significantly changed from last year? And if they're not, if they're changed, I don't think they're changed for the better. And there's much more competition. So where are the Celtics?
Yeah, the Celtics are kind of emblematic of my point about the Sixers, and that I was kind of just underwhelmed by what everybody else did. Like Boston losing Gordon Hayward, and I mean, look, Tristan Thompson is a piece that will help them, assuming he's healthy and able to play like he did at times last year and not the year before, especially when they go up against bigger physical centers like Bam Adebayo, for example, who for as good a season as Daniel Tice had last year, he got demolished by Bam in that conference finals, and he could not hold up against him physically. And frankly, when you saw the Celtics play the Heat in the seeding games and saw Bam just throwing guys around like a rag doll, you kind of said, well, this could be a tricky matchup if this ends up happening down the road for them. And sure enough, it was. But he will help with that. But look, Gordon Hayward last year averaged 17-6-4 as the fourth option on this team, was the team's best passer, and, you know, really gave them four elite wing players with Kemba, five wing players actually, with Kemba Walker, Marcus Smart, the two young guys and Gordon, that you could rotate through and have probably three of those guys out there on the court at all times. And by losing him, now you're relying on Romeo Langford, who's out for 2 months with a wrist injury, rookies like Aaron Nesmith, who you have no idea what they're going to do. You know, there's not a lot of depth on that wing. And now you have Kemba Walker, who's also out. So now it's going to be Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum and, you know, Jeff Teague in like his 12th NBA season, who looked kind of shot last year in Atlanta. And, you know, you're going to have Grant Williams playing, who's become, who was a better spot up shooter than people remember at the beginning of his rookie season when he went 0 for 26, I think, from three. But again, like not a dynamic guy with the ball. Like it's just going to be really interesting to see how the season goes, because I could see, I think there's a better, much better chance of Boston finishing, say, fifth or sixth in the East than there is finishing first or second. Which despite having these two young guys, there's just a lot of question marks, basically up and down the rest of the entire roster for a variety of reasons.
Unless Tatum becomes like, you know, borderline MVP candidate and is carrying a night in and night out.
Well, even if both those guys take another big step forward, like, yes, then maybe they can overcome that. But even still, I mean, you're talking about those two guys and then you're talking about a ton of question marks, really, other than Marcus Smart. Like, you know, at that, after that, your probably next most reliable player on the team is Grant Williams, who's a second year forward.
The thing is, Kemba Walker, it was the second most effective pick and roll player in the league last year behind Damian Lillard. He's just does so much for you. And Kevin, I mean, ultimately they need Kemba healthy at the back, not at the front. But I just laid out at the start of this thing that the margin for error at the top is thin. I mean, this is what Tim is talking about.
Yeah, I mean, they were a team that really needed to stay healthy this season, and they're going to go into the season not particularly healthy. So I think, you know, even if Tatum and Brown do take that step in their development, I think that probably helps them more in the playoffs than it does the regular season, because they're still going to have, you know, what is it, 40 minutes a night that you're going to have, 60 minutes a night that you're going to have to fill on the perimeter with guys who are unproven or rookies, or as Tim mentioned with Jeff Teague, you know, on the tail end of their career. And I think it was kind of unfortunate for the Celtics that by the time they found out about where Gordon Hayward was going, there wasn't really a lot of perimeter options left for them with that non-taxpayer mid-level exception that they suddenly had access to. So, you know, I understand why they went with Tristan Thompson, but he upgraded a position they were already reasonably deep at, and they didn't get much help at the other spots. I in particular, I'm surprised that they didn't make more of an effort to go after Shabazz Napier at point guard, who is someone who played pretty well and, you know, both coming off the bench and time starting last season. So, you know, I would have felt much better if they had signed him to be the guy along with Peyton Pritchard, who, you know, I like his game. I'm glad he's not going to be going up against UW anymore, but it's a lot to expect any rookie this season to contribute in a rotation role for a winning team.
Brad Stevens has liked Jeff Teague since he was recruiting him in Indiana. So I think that's part of it. And I think they would have gone after Tristan anyway. He's a guy that I think Danny Ainge has had interest in for a while. But I'm with you, KP. They have tons of questions behind those. You know, they've got Marcus, Jalen, and Jason on the wing, and they've got all kinds of questions after that. I mean, if any of those guys get hurt at all, this team is in real trouble.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and on the Ways to Win podcast, coaches Craig Robinson and John Calipari are here to help. Each week, Craig and Coach Cal use their on-court wisdom to solve your off-court problems. Whether it's trouble at home or a workplace dilemma, the coaches will help you find a winning formula for success. And you'll hear from prominent athletes, business leaders, and celebrities who reveal insights that made them into the leaders they are today. Like President Obama, who breaks down his bracket and talks about how he deals with pressure by projecting confidence, believing in your team, and taking criticism. Listen to Ways to Win wherever you get your podcasts. Now let's talk about the play of the week, the pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavily on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liquor, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. These next few teams we're going to talk about are pretty damn good. First off, in the finals last year, bringing back the heart of their roster, the Miami Heat, really positioned themselves pretty well to compete not only this year, but potentially get involved in any big transactions this year. They are somewhat of an interesting hardened destination if Philly and Brooklyn don't work out, if only because they've got young assets. However, they're already out two future first round picks, and they can't trade a first round pick right now until 2027. They could unprotect a pick that they owe the Thunder in 2023, and then they could trade 25 and 27, but you know, that would be a difficult trade, but let's put that aside for now. That'll be talked about later. Miami, this became a storyline in the last week, and I'm not sure why. The concept that the Heat were some sort of a fluke team, I guess that's because they feel like the bubble messed with stuff. I mean, look, they flat out beat the number one overall seed. They pounded them. And, you know, I mean, I don't think that wasn't like they hit three half court shots. You know, did they benefit? Yeah, because I think Tyler Hero was awesome for them in the bubble. And he wouldn't probably have been that good if he had played in the spring. Number one, he was injured in the spring, but this is a big time legit team with upward mobility. That said, they could finish with the fourth best record. I don't know. Kevin, I doubt you would be, but you're not in agreement that they were a fluke last year, do you?
I definitely wouldn't call them a fluke. I don't think that we can necessarily count on them to duplicate what they did in the playoffs.
Boy, that was a hedge.
Yeah, I mean, I inspired by you, Mindy. I put them at the top of that group that's, you know, probably the next tier contenders after Milwaukee. I still think Milwaukee certainly in the regular season and even in the playoffs, because I do expect Giannis to take that step forward I talked about earlier, has the best chance to get out of the East. But of the rest of the conference, I think I like Miami the best because, you know, they did a nice job of getting Goran Dragic back, and the free agents that they did lose, Jay Crowder and Derek Jones Jr., replacing them with good values in Avery Bradley and Maurice Harkless. It's not exactly like for like. They've gotten a little bit smaller with those moves, but you know, they're still going to be extremely deep, and they've got two, you know, really good star players, and they've got some quality young talent that could take a step forward again. So, you know, will I be surprised if the Heat make the finals? Not at all.
Yeah, I think to your point, Brian, I don't think they are a fluke, but like you talked about with Tyler Hero, you know, the thing that I'm most curious about, one of the things I'm most curious about after spending time in the bubble watching these games is how some of these guys that blew up there play coming out of it. Jamal Murray is a guy like that. Donovan Mitchell is a guy like that. And Tyler Hero is a guy like that. Like, he became an essential piece for the Heat in the playoffs. I mean, he almost single-handedly got him and Bam were really the reasons they got past the Celtics in the end with that game. I think that Hero had in game four when he had 30-something. You know, that really was the thing to put the nail in the coffin for Boston that series. So I'm curious to see how much of a step forward Hero makes in this second season, because they really need him to be.
It's kind of like Bam and Hero. We know what Jimmy Butler is going to be.
Right.
We know Duncan Robinson is going to hit a bunch of threes.
Right.
Hero, he, you know, whether he keeps going up, and Bam, whether he keeps going up, really defines whether this team is going to have to, you know, sort of scrap their way through, or could be a shot at the number one seed.
No question.
I can't rule out that they won't both get better, frankly.
No, you read my mind, because the two questions I have about this team are, can Hero like play like he did in the bubble over the course of 82 or now 72 games this season? And can Bam get any kind of a perimeter shot? Because the one thing that's lacking from his game is a consistent long-range shot, even from 18 feet, but especially if he could get out to the three-point line. Like, he has a decent stroke. I think it's something he can add over time. But if he could add that this year, you know, all of a sudden that makes, when he's out there, that gives them more versatility with their lineups, and it just makes them that much more dynamic on offense if he can do that. So, I mean, to me, those are the two big swing questions with them that, like you said, could determine whether Miami is pushing for first in the East or whether they're pushing for, you know, fourth or fifth and, you know, kind of being back in the same spot they were last year.
Two advanced stats I want to bring up from this team. One, the most efficient duo in the league last year. More than Anthony Davis and LeBron James, more than Jamal Murray, Nikola Jokic, pick your duo.
I believe you meant LeBron James and Alex Caruso.
Was Bam Adebayo playing two-man game with Duncan Robinson. Whether it was a handoff or a pick and roll or just a flat-out pass, when Bam Adebayo passed the ball to Duncan Robinson, the Heat averaged 1.3 points per possession. To put that in perspective, if you have any play that is one, that's very good. If you 1 point per possession is very strong. So that's 30% better than that. That was the most efficient duo in the league. So just keep an eye on that and remind of that. Second thing is this, this was where Hero was so remarkable. During the regular season, now again, he's a rookie. He averaged 0.8 points per possession on pick and rolls, which is not good. You'd want him to be the ball handler on the pick and roll like that. In the bubble, he averaged 1.15. So he went from being like 20% below good to 15% above good on that play. And I mean, you could just see the way the guy hit picks and the way the guy attacked was night and day. And I have no idea whether those two stats will come up, but if you have one of the best pick and roll attack players and you have the best, most efficient, you know, and the thing about it is, you know, Bam and Duncan Robinson can go work together and do their two man game without having to have Dragic or Jimmy Butler or Hero, you know, use it. I mean, talk about a way to get points and relief, you know? So, those are two things. I don't know if they're duplicatable. Certainly, it's not like Duncan Robinson is going to not hit threes. I don't know if he'll hit them at that level with Bam Adebayo, but that's two weapons right there that, you know, we'll have to see. I'm sorry that it took this long to bring this team up, because they're probably the most team I'm interested in watching, the Brooklyn Nets, but it just, the East is that's the nature of them. My viewpoint on the Nets is that they are going to have moments where they look absolutely awesome, and you are going to watch them play, and you are going to watch Durant missed 550 days, and he is a guy who I don't think needs much athleticism. He's the greatest, in my view, the greatest scorer of my lifetime. I don't know where he'll end up in the stats, but I think that, you know, when Kyrie is on, I mean, the guy scored 50 points his first game as a Net last year. And there are going to be nights where the ball's popping out to Joe Harris and popping out to Landry Shamet, and they're hitting their threes. And DeAndre Jordan is getting rebound and blocking shots. And Caris LeVert looks really good. Steve Nash brought up, I think, kind of sort of quasi-announced he's going to bring Caris off the bench. and he's going to come off the bench. And there are going to be times where I feel like you're going to be like, oh my God, this team is winning the East and going seven games with the Lakers, and it's going to be LeBron Durant, you know, part four. And I think there's going to be other times where they are on the back page 5 days in a row of the New York tabloids because of some drama, whether it's real or created. And so I think they're going to be a very compelling team. Bontemps, former Nets beat writer. You and I have talked privately about how this personalities are very different, but it's reminiscent of that 12-13 season when they brought in Pierce and Garnett to that team that had Deron Williams. And there was all these expectations, and there was this brand new coach, Jason Kidd, and this whole season was one giant crazy roller coaster. I think we could have something like that again.
Yeah, there's a good chance that's going to happen, but I'm just going to focus on the basketball. Who is going to guard anyone on this team? Like, are they going to, I mean, they might be able to win a lot of games, winning 150 to 145, but they're not going to guard anybody. And to me, setting aside all the chemistry stuff, which is obviously is something to monitor, that's the thing that I want to see about this team. Because if they're starting Kyrie, Spencer, Joe Harris, Kevin Durant, and DeAndre Jordan, there's not an above average defender in that starting lineup. There's maybe one or two average defenders, but well, that's not a team that's going to
DeAndre Jordan when he feels like it, but he hasn't in a few years.
DeAndre's no better than average at this point, and probably worse. And on the bench, they don't exactly have anybody coming in that's going to be a stopper behind them. So that, I mean, look, they're going to be really good on offense. But even this game tonight, you know, Sunday night, they played the Wizards without anybody on the team playing. I think Beal and Westbrook and Bertans were all out, and they were up 25 or something in the first half, and KD and Kyrie were making shots left and right. And I had a scout text me in the second half and said, weren't the Nets up by like 50 in this game? How's it tied? And it was tied like 2 minutes into the third quarter with those guys still playing, if I'm correct. So they're going to be in a lot of games like that, and they're good enough offensively that they're probably going to win a lot. But we've never really seen a team that just doesn't play defense really be able to go all the way to the finals. And I think unless they do something to rectify that with this group, I just think they have somewhat of a ceiling, because I just don't see how they can have any kind of a good defense.
Tim, beat me to that point. What's your numbers expect, Pelton, for this team?
Tim beat me to my point again, and this is kind of why I liked them going in for Jrue Holiday, even, I don't know if I want to say more so than Bradley Beal given his age, or James Harden.
I'll say it, especially for James Harden. Jrue Holiday would have been way better for them than James Harden. I'll just say that.
Well, they don't have either, so it's.
Well, I know, but I'm just saying, in terms of everybody getting all excited about James Harden, they don't need another offensive player who doesn't play defense on a team full of guys who don't play defense.
I mean, they brought in Bruce Brown Jr., who is a capable perimeter defender, but I don't know how much he's going to play because he's also not as good offensively or as a shooter as, you know, a lot of the other guys they brought in, including Landry Shamet, who they dealt for, I guess it was days later, because that the offseason was so compressed. The projections that I do based on our real plus minus stat project the Nets number one in the league offensively and 27th in defensive rating.
That's actually just about what I would have guessed. I would have guessed third and 27th. So that sounds about right.
I think I'd take the over or the under on 27, since I think, you know, they'll be more motivated down the stretch than a lot of
teams. You're obviously not going to know this, but like, what's the best record that a team that ranks 27th in defense can expect to have?
Maybe the equivalent of like a 48 win, 50 win pace over a full season.
Which you know, they win 48 games. That would not be good with this team.
But I think, you know, to your original point, yeah, this season is not going to be determined by how many games the Nets win during the regular season. They might have a mediocre regular season, and then, you know, they start playing KD 40 minutes a night in the playoffs if he can handle that, and all of a sudden it looks different in the playoffs. I mean, that's where I do slightly disagree with Tim. I think the ceiling is higher than the median outcome for this team.
Well, when I say the ceiling, I just like KP, I bet has there ever been an NBA team? How many NBA teams have made the finals, do you think, with bottom 10 defenses?
Well, some of those late era, second era Cleveland teams with LeBron, I think.
I'm pretty sure they were never in the bottom 10.
The year that, you know, they might have been one, but the years where they were actually competitive, the first 2 years, they were much better defensively. I mean, I always say to score in game seven. The score of game seven was 91-87.
And some of those teams' issues were like lack of effort slash care factors defensively, which like the Nets don't have anyone who guards people. Like that's like they fundamentally don't have defenders on their team. Like, yes, they have Bruce Brown, but like Bruce Brown's their ninth man. Like they're, you know, Karis, Spencer, Kyrie, Joe Harris, Kevin Durant, none of those guys are those guys are average or worse. And most of them are worse. So that's my thing. Like, yes, they're going to be unbelievable to watch and they're going to be super fun. But I just, when push comes to shove in a playoff series, if they can't get consistent stops defensively, I just don't, it's hard for me to see them being a finals team unless they go out and make a trade for a significant upgrade at the defensive end somewhere down the road this season that changes that.
So you have, I don't know if you want to roll this out, Bontemps. You actually have a dream trade that you think would change everything.
Oh, I've talked about it. I've talked about it, I think, on the pod before. Okay. I think if Rudy Gobert doesn't get extended, if I was the Brooklyn Nets, I would rather
He probably will get extended.
I think he's going to get extended. I think he'll be in Utah. I think Rudy Gobert is better for the Nets than James Harden also. I think if the Nets got Rudy Gobert, that would be he'd probably be a bigger upgrade for them than any other team in the league just because of the stuff he'd be able to do defensively. He'd obviously be playing over DeAndre Jordan, who's a significant upgrade over. And it just that would give them a chance to have a good enough defense to go with their offense. Yeah. They'd have a chance to reach the ceiling that people think they have.
He probably is getting extended, but let's just say for some reason he wouldn't get extended, like he couldn't agree. Then the Nets would, you know, trade all of their prospects basically for him.
Yeah, like Caris LeVert and Jared Allen and a pick or two. I mean, is a trade that, you know, maybe you throw in something else, but that's a trade that makes some sense for Utah, and it makes all the sense in the world for Brooklyn.
I mean, like to your point, like nobody would ever get excited about. Well, I shouldn't say nobody, but that wouldn't be a trade that would lead SportsCenter speculation, like, you know, Harden would. But my God, can you I think that's an amazing concept. But whether it's defensive player of the year level or not, transactionally, as they look at their options, I think your point is they should be thinking about defensive options.
Yeah, KP was right. The Bruce Brown move is a really nice move. He's a nice piece, but that's just not nearly enough to fix what is a pretty glaring problem.
Vivid Seats wants you to get to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket. With Vivid Seat Rewards, score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code HOOP. That's code HOOP, H-O-O-P. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, but nothing on your roof. So who's ever up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Team that was champs 2 years ago, number two seed last year, ran out of gas in the second round. Toronto Raptors. Again, champs 2 years ago, number two seed last year. I see no reason why they're going to be a little bit disadvantaged because they have no home games, but nobody has home games for a long time. KP, Raptors won 53 games last year, 53-19. They're bringing back the core of that roster. I know they lost Serge and Marcus Gasol, but, you know, Van Vliet, Kyle Lowry, Pascal Siakam, those are three high-level players, excellent coaching. Where do the Raptors fall in this menagerie of competition that we keep going over?
I think they've got an excellent chance of finishing with a better record than other than Milwaukee, all these other teams we've talked about for, you know, the reasons you laid out. And I'd add OG Anunoby as a fourth guy who has played his way into that group of, you know, not quite maybe at their level of, you know, in all-star consideration, but he's emerged as one of the best wing stoppers in the league and a quality three-point shooter. It's going to be interesting to see what happens since, you know, they have to manage his extension in the next week here while trying to save cap space for the Giannis pursuit like so many of these other teams. But, you know, I don't think that the loss at center is going to dramatically change what they do. They brought in, you know, Aaron Baines and Alex Len, who are solid centers, brought back Chris Boucher, who gives them a really interesting shot blocker who can also shoot threes. And they played with, you know, one of those two guys injured and some of their perimeter guys injured a lot last season. So if they have better health, I think they can have a pretty similar record to last year, even if they're not quite as strong a team.
Montemps, you're really high on OG, right?
All right, well, KP, I texted KP last night and said if you wanted me to tell him my a bold take I had for the pod, and he almost stole it, but he didn't quite. I was actually bolstered by texting with a scout last night who said this bold take, that he had the same bold take as me before I said it to him. But I think OG is going to make the All-Star team this year. It's my bold take of the year. It's a bit out there. He hasn't had the kind of statistical profile up to now that you would think would lead to him having that kind of a year. But in the brief amount of time that I've talked to him, you know, via these, you know, the Zoom situation we're all in this year, he just seems vastly more confident and self-assured than he has before. And watching their game against the Hornets, he physically looks great. His three-point shot looks good. The loss of both Serge and Mark is going to open up a ton of opportunities on offense, I think, for him. I think he's going to take advantage of it. The other thing that's interesting about them is the end of the first half of that game, going to that small lineup with Pascal at center or OG at center, whoever you want to put there, that they basically never played before the playoffs because they always had Serge and Mark out there at center. And I think this year you're going to see the Raptors play small. I'm with KP. I think in the regular season with Nick Nurse and with their group, I think they're going to win a ton of games. I do wonder if they're going to run into the same problems on offense in the playoffs where they just don't have enough juice in the half court to really get past maybe a really tough second round matchup. But again, like if OG takes the kind of leap I think he's capable of, maybe, you know, between him and Pascal and Fred and the guys they have, maybe collectively they can have a bit more juice this year and be able to get a bit farther.
Well, he shot 51% last year as a third year player. I know obviously he wasn't a prime. He was getting eight field goals attempts a game. Should go up a little bit if he continues. 51%, just that's terrific. 39% on threes. He's improved his shooting and scoring every year. And like I said, you know, self-assuredness.
And he's a physical marvel too. I mean, he's so good on defense. I mean, he's really blossoming into a player. And like I said, I think just how high their ceiling is to me, it all comes down to him. Pascal's going to be really good. Fred and Kyle are going to be good. Norm's going to be really good off the bench. You know, they need OG to take the leap they've kind of been waiting for him to take, and the one they think he can, for them to really be, you know, in the conversation at the very top of what's a pretty loaded top of the East.
Right. Well, one of the reasons why Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster, their front office, are so highly valued. Yes, they make the Kawhi Leonard trade, you know, huge guts trade leads to their championship. Yes, they make the Nick Nurse hire, which, you know, took them weeks and, you know, was, I don't know if it's controversial, but it was a bit of a risk. They were turning the keys over to this guy who'd never been a head coach in the NBA. But the drafting that they have done with this team and the overall personnel that they have done, whether it's been Norm Powell in the second round, whether it's been Fred VanVleet, you know, they've done great with non-drafted players. And Pascal Siakam and OG Anunoby, who were, you know, OG was not a lottery pick, right?
I mean, they were the 23rd and 27th picks, OG right. And Pascal.
I mean, we're just talking about them being two core cornerstones of their team. This is how you do this. And you know, this is going to be their pitch, whether it's to Giannis or another free agent. Look at what we can do here and look what we can build here. But, you know, I'm going last with the, you know, I took the Raptors last, but again, I would ignore them at your peril. And Kyle Lowry loves playing golf and will get to play golf all year long now because he's in Tampa. And so who knows what that could do for Kyle's overall game. So out of those teams we just did, we just went through the six top teams. Two of those dudes ain't making out of the first round. And I know it's a lot more than the first round in the NBA, but that we went through a lot of powerhouse. I mean, all of those teams we just talked about have a lot going for them. Okay, so sort of the middle team there is the Pacers. It's hard for me to know what the Pacers are going to be. I did watch a little bit of their first preseason game against the Cavs Saturday night. Oladipo had some moments. Domantas Sabonis has grown his hair out, looks completely different than when he came into the league. Miles Turner looked good. I don't know where the Pacers are going to be. TJ Warren was a marvel. Bubble Jordan, they called him, but he is like 9 months later still having foot problems. This is a team that was primed for a trade, tried to do something with Gordon Hayward, couldn't get it done. Bontemps, make an argument why this team should be in that group of the top six.
I'm not going to. I have concerns about the Pacers. I am hopeful for Nate Bjorkman, who is a grinder. I was in the G League for a long time assistant for Nick Nurse. I'm happy for him getting a chance to coach that team. But Nate McMillan did a really good job coaching the Pacers and kind of maximizing what that team had. And every year you kind of see one team that you don't expect to have issues. And I kind of wonder if this year it's going to be the Pacers. You have Victor Oladipo in a contract year. He did not look good last year. Can he bounce back and play well? We'll see. But that whole situation is going to be weird. You mentioned the Gordon Hayward thing that, Miles Turner, they tried to move in that deal, couldn't get it done. Are they going to finally be able to break up Sabonis and Turner? We'll see. You mentioned TJ Warren. He's had plantar fasciitis in some form since September. He still has it. He's week to week. Who knows when he's going to be able to, when he's going to be able to play for them. They need him to play. I just, when you talk about how good those top six are, and we're going to talk about a couple of these other teams are going to be pushing behind them, I just wonder if the Pacers are going to be in a bit of a middle ground this year, given everything that's going on with them.
All right, Pelton, what does your machine say?
It has the Pacers right in the mix there with that, Boston, Brooklyn group. But, I agree with Tim. I mean, a lot of what they did the past few years, I think, is attributable to the fact that as much as you might want to lament Nate McMillan's playoff coaching, he gets a lot out of his teams in the regular season. And Dan Burke got a lot out of these guys at the defensive end of the court. He was a big pickup for Philadelphia this offseason, very quiet as an assistant coach on Doc Rivers' staff. He'd been in Indiana dating back to when Larry Bird brought him there as a coach. So that's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out. But it's weird that we have so many question marks about a team whose biggest offseason addition was Keelan Martin.
Like I said, all right. So there's quite a, not that you would spend a whole lot of time getting excited about 7, 8, 9, 10 seeds in this case, but there's an arms race back there. You have the Charlotte Hornets signing Gordon Hayward to a $120 million contract. They did not do that to miss the playoffs. Also hopping up in the lottery, getting LaMelo Ball, who's going to be a player we're going to be watching just to watch him throw passes. You have the Washington Wizards, who definitely feel the pressure rising on Bradley Beal, give a huge contract to Davis Bertans, and then very aggressively go get Russell Westbrook. And then the Atlanta Hawks, who spent a whole ton of money. And quite frankly, I believe there's significant expectation there from ownership, get us back to the playoffs. That doesn't mention the Orlando Magic, who actually did make the playoffs last year, kind of spun their wheels this offseason. I want to talk about Atlanta first. They make a whole bunch of additions, Rondo, Gallinari, Bogdan Bogdanovic. But in my view, they had a very interesting signing with Chris Dunn at $4.5 million. Trey Young ranked 2 years ago 520th out of 520 players in the NBA in real plus minus on defense. And last year ranked 513th out of 513 on defense, real plus minus. Unequivocally the worst defensive player in the league. Now, a brilliant offensive player. Chris Dunn has been a top five player at point guard defense. Obviously, Dunn was available for $4 million for various reasons, but that was a key addition. And then you bring the firepower of Gallinari and Bogdanovic. Pelton, how much better are the Hawks going to be? Are they going to be good enough to get into that playoff spot? Because if they're not, people's jobs are going to be on the line.
I think so. I mean, I've got them in my projections as a 500 team now. It's a really deep team.
A lot of money for 500. Well, the East is tough.
But 500 would be a pretty big upgrade from where they've been the last year.
They were 20 and 47 last year.
So, you know, part of what happened here is it's hard to upgrade if your team, and this might apply as we were talking about Indiana, like if you've got a bunch of solid players, it's really hard to upgrade on them. But if you're a team that has these huge liabilities in your rotation, as the Hawks did last season, then even bringing in a league average player is going to be a huge upgrade for you. And in addition to all the money they spent this offseason, they've also got Clint Capela coming in at center, where
he never played for him last season.
Right. He looked, you know, I watched their preseason opener, looks to have instant chemistry with Trae Young, not surprising. He's a really ideal fit in the pick and roll game for them. So, you know, I think this team is going to be dramatically improved. And if they aren't, you mentioned the pressure, and we just talked about Nate McMillan. They brought him in as a lead assistant to Lloyd Pierce, and that feels like the move where you're hiring the replacement if you get off to a slow start.
I don't think you have to say it feels like it. That was pretty pretty obviously.
Well, Nate McMillan announced he was taking a year off, and then he all of a sudden he was like, well, wait a minute.
Yes.
So did Daryl Morey.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if that was congruent, but go ahead.
No, I just KP hit it on the head. I really like this Hawks team. I think they're going to be a lot better. You know, they essentially added three free agent pieces. You know, Clint Capela didn't even play for them before the trade deadline or after the trade deadline. Him, Danilo Gallinari, and Bogdan Bogdanovic are good NBA players. You add three good NBA players to a team with already got some young talent. And I think that there's a better chance that the Hawks finished seventh than 10th. And, you know, as you alluded to, Brian, there's definitely pressure there. You know, Tony Ressler and Jamie Gertz, his wife, were at the game tonight watching them play the Magic in their second preseason game. And
they live in L.A., so.
Yes, they you know, Ressler, they want to win and they want to be good. I think I'm pretty sure that Jamie Gertz said I think she was on the day or was the person who was on the podium for the Hawks. And I think she said, my goal is to not have to be back here again. So, you know, they expect to be in the playoffs, and frankly, they should after these moves. Like they're good. I think they're a good team. And look, Trey, his defense has been terrible, but with these additions that they've made, especially Capela, you know, their center position was the worst position maybe in the entire league for any team last year. That should make them much better. And, you know, he's got to play better on defense too. I mean, it's a big year for, I think, them up and down the board to see just how good they can be.
So Kevin,
Hawks small forward.
Yes, that's true. That was also bad, but at least they were playing prospects there at center. They were not.
So Kevin, I've had Bontemps and I have had pretty interesting discussions about the Gordon Hayward addition for Charlotte. I certainly recognize that in Charlotte, getting a free agent is a challenge, although they did sign Terry Rozier last year. Going all in at this price point, not only getting Hayward, but also having to waive Nick Batum and have $9 million sit on your books for the next 3 years, essentially Gordon Hayward is going to look like $37 million or so, $38 million on their books for the next 3 years. I don't know. It was a weird one to go all in on. Bontemps, I don't want to put words in his mouth. Bontemps feels like this is a move that they had to make to upgrade this talent because they just didn't have.
No,
much.
That's not my position at all. That's the absolute wrong position, but good job.
Kevin, how does Hayward does this make a difference? Are they making the playoffs? Because to me, spending all this money on one player, I'm not sure that it really materially makes them that much different of a team. And I think they were one of the worst rebounding teams in the league last year. They didn't address that. And it's just, to me, I view it as Batum, and I view it as basically you're paying him $38 million. So he better be an all-star this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can justify paying $30 million a year for a guy like Hayward, who has played at a sub-all-star level since his injury and is, you know, at an age where he's going to begin declining. If you're a player away and you can really maximize the money you're spending in the first couple of years, even if you know it might get ugly on the back end of the contract, but the Hornets are like three players away. They're maybe a player away from the play-in. I think they've got a reasonable chance of getting there. And that would have been hard for them to do otherwise. But, you know, especially if they give LaMelo Ball big minutes, as much fun as he is and as excited as he is as a prospect, and he was my number one prospect in this year's draft, he's going to be really bad in terms of helping your team win or lose games this season.
Yeah, I agree with that. My point about Charlotte is that I can at least justify the decision they made to pay Gordon Hayward, as opposed to like what some other teams, like say Detroit, who is so bad we're really not going to talk about them, I don't think, on this podcast, did.
Well, let's not have the standard be better than Detroit.
But that my point in our argument privately is that I can at least see the logic behind what Charlotte did, whereas I can't see the logic behind what Detroit did. So I never said I would do it. I personally would not have done that if I was Charlotte. But I also think it's better that they stretch Nick Batum if they were going to do this than trying to trade him, because even with the stretch and even with Gordon Hayward on their books, they still have $35 million in cap room next year when there's not going to be that many people to sign anyway, and they're probably not going to get another good player to come there. So again, I would not have signed Gordon Hayward personally if I was the Hornets. I would have done something different, but getting a good player there, I can at least understand it. And to Kevin's point, like I watched that Hornets Raptors game on Saturday night. LaMelo Ball is super fun. He made three or four passes that maybe yelled during the game in a preseason game. He's going to be great fun. He also had four turnovers and was 0-for-5, and none of the shots were that close. And it's going to really be a drag
shoot.
On that.
I mean, he cannot shoot. Now, maybe he will be able to shoot by the spring. Maybe he will be able to shoot by year three, but this is my whole thing with him being the number one prospect. I can't get excited about a guy in 2020-21 who shot 25% from three in the Australian League.
Well, just wait until you find out about this year's prospects, because there's a lot of guys who have great basketball IQ, great passers, can't shoot, though.
I like shooting. I'm sorry if that makes me a weirdo. Washington Wizards were a team 25-47 last year. Wall missed the whole year. Beal put up great numbers on a bad team. They have some guys on this roster that are intriguing. Scott Brooks is in the last year of his contract. He is, I'm sure, expected to make the playoffs. Bontemps is Russell Westbrook. Is his infusion of what he brings, is this enough to be a difference-making player? Obviously, they're going to upgrade a point guard. They were starting Isaiah Thomas there much of last year. Is this enough?
I think it's enough to get the Wizards into the play-in game, or play-in games, I should say. I'm not quite sure if they're going to be good enough to be a playoff team. I think they're kind of a homeless version of the Nets, in that I think they're going to be incredibly fun to watch on a nightly basis, and they're going to score a ton of points, but they also have nobody who's going to guard anyone, and they could give up 145 points a game. Denny Avijah, the rookie from Israel, had a really nice game against Brooklyn tonight. I am curious to see if he ends up being their starting three next to Rui Hachimura in the front court. It's probably going to be him or Troy Brown, but I just don't think they have enough defense to be a real playoff threat. And I think they're probably a step below Indiana and Atlanta, for those 7-8 spots. But the Wizards are going to be in the mix, and they're certainly going to be interesting with the whole Bradley Beal, Russell Westbrook experiment. I'm curious to see how it goes.
I mean, it wouldn't be surprising to me if they got up to 500. I just think, though, if you're this team that is so desperate to get into the playoffs this year and chase every advantage you can, you know, Scott Brooks has been a quality, competent NBA coach over the course of his career, but he's not that guy who's going to stagger Russell Westbrook and Bradley Beal to make sure their minutes are separated as much as possible, or get on Russell Westbrook about his shot selection. So there seems to be an incongruence between, you know, their goals and, you know, what they're trying to do besides give you up future draft picks.
All right, well, we've gone long enough. I apologize if we didn't get to your team. I'm sorry, Cleveland, Chicago, New York, Detroit. We'll see how the season goes, and we'll talk about them then. Thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective Podcast. Thank you, Troy, who is in Mission Control in Bristol tonight. Thank you to Kevin. Thank you to Tim. Appreciate listening, everybody. Have a great week.